London Column. This is Peter Watson once again presenting a weekly radio digest of items headlined or modest, but all selected for your interest and entertainment from the worldwide services of the BBC. London Column. It's something of an honour for a mere Englishman to be allowed to introduce this edition, because the all-pervading influence of Scotland has swamped us once again. In the voice of a Scots shepherd who tends his sheep in the very heart of London, in a Scots reporter's account of military ceremony in London, and in the voice of Queen Elizabeth, herself a Scot, at an ancient Scottish seat of learning. First then, the royal occasion. Five 500 years ago, St. Andrew's University in Scotland was established as the first great seat of learning in the then independent kingdom north of the border. To celebrate the 500 years of its history, men of learning from the world over recently came to St. Andrew's University, and with them, as they made ceremonial procession through the town, was Queen Elizabeth. Among the blues and gold and purples of the gowns and hoods of her colleagues, there stood out strikingly the scarlet robe of the Queen's Doctorate of Laws, conferred upon her 20 years ago. A university luncheon, and who could better point to the world-embracing initiative of the Scots than the Queen, herself a daughter of Scotland, her home that very Glamis castle of Shakespearean legend.
My many journeys overseas have given me unusual opportunities of seeing the great part played by Scotsmen, not only in my own country, but wherever the traveller may go. So numerous do they seem in Canada, in Australia, South Africa, and elsewhere, that I've sometimes been anxious, unnecessarily, I'm glad to say, lest on my return I should find Scotland completely depopulated. Unwearying in times of peace, as they are undaunted in war, they have carried to the ends of the world those qualities which have made that country great. Upon what, I wonder, are those qualities founded? First, I think upon the simplicity and integrity of countless Scottish homes, where children have for generations learned the Christian way of life. And next, upon the schools and academies of Scotland, where devoted teachers have never been lacking to meet that zeal for scholarship which has always inspired the youth of Scotland, and I trust always will.
And while any Scots descended listeners recover from their blushes, let me tell you that all migrant Scots are not captains of industry or builders of empire. Some have exported their mastery of the gentler crafts too. And Doc Mackay will prove our point for us. Here, in the very heart of London, in the vast green acres of tree-sheltered Hyde Park, here are the tranquilly grazing flocks of sheep that surprise even Londoners, never mind strangers in town. Flocks of London sheep, then, and guarding them, a Highland Scots shepherd, Doc Mackay. And we ask another Highlander, MacDonald Prane, to meet him for you.
Well, Jock, how long have you been down here in London?
I've been here 13 summers.
Yes, and what part of Scotland do you come from?
Dali, Aberdeenshire.
Oh, yes, that's up in the northeast, isn't it?
That's right.
Yes, now, the sheep here in you have down here in London, why do they have them in the park here?
Well, to keep the grass down, and I think the London people like to see them too.
I wouldn't be surprised. And how many sheep do you think there are altogether? How many do you have in your flock?
Well, I've got about 400.
Well, they certainly look very happy here. I mean, I can see them wandering around under the trees there. There seems to be any amount of food for them. The grass is plenty nourishment in it. But there must be some troubles. How about the public?
Oh, the public is quite good.
Quite good. You mean, do you think they like the idea of having sheep in London?
Yes, I think they do.
Now, Look, standing here and seeing the sheep roaming around all over the park, it must be very difficult to keep them under control. How do you manage that?
Well, I've got my dogs, and they do fairly well.
You couldn't manage without your dogs?
I couldn't manage without my dogs.
What breed are they, actually?
They're Border Collies.
Uh-huh. And with all the public in the park here, when they walk through, you see the kids playing around. Look at that over there. You can see kids running around the sheep, don't they? Disturb the sheep and interfere with the grazing, surely.
Well, the sheep soon get acquainted with them, you know. The sheep don't mind them very much.
You mean they get used to the town life, do they?
Yes, they get used to the town life.
Well, they're extraordinary looking sheep to me. They look they're very dark colour. Well, what kind of sheep are they, actually? What breed are they?
Well, they're Suffolk crosses, but seeing the wools are dark, that's a London swap, you see.
You mean That's caused by the pollution of the atmosphere, so to speak, in London.
Yes.
Well, now, I have always thought a shepherd's life to be, you know, a very lonely one, and one doesn't expect to see one right here in the heart of London. How do you like it being here? Would you prefer to be back in the moors again, or would you like it here?
Oh, I prefer to be here.
Why is that now?
Well, I like the London life. You can go and have an evening, you know, and you feel like it.
I see. But you don't miss the actual the loneliness of the moor or the country life?
Oh, no.
Oh, well, that's fine.
And now from bleating to blaring brass, because this London is a city of contrasting noises as well as sights. Beating the retreat at sunset is a ceremony observed at every barracks in the country. But it has a special twist in London, since during the last couple of years, a bigger than usual show has been put on every Thursday on the Horse Guards Parade. Two bands, provided by whatever regiments are doing London duty at the time, a special show for Londoners and their overseas guests, in fact. And we asked our Scots reporter Sheila Stewart to look in on it.
The origin of beating the retreat is rather obscure. It's certainly one of the oldest calls in the British Army, and it's probable that in the days when darkness put an end to fighting for the day, its object was to warn stragglers to retreat to the safety of the camp and to collect guards for the night watch. Anyway, whatever its origin, it's laid down in the King's regulations for this very day that retreat shall be beaten at sunset. I went down to the Horse Guards Parade on one of those early autumn evenings that are most becoming of all to London, with a clear eggshell blue sky. As we came through the Horse Guards Arch onto the great parade ground, the trees of St. James's Park ahead of us were silhouetted against a sunset sky full of soft pinky clouds. On three sides, the square was lined with hundreds of people, Londoners, folks up from the country, and visitors from overseas, all gathered together to watch this grand spectacle. And then, suddenly, in the distance, came the sound of the pipes. And out of the trees at the far end of the square, the pipers of the Irish Guards appeared, their saffron kilts swinging and their long green cloaks floating from their shoulders to their heels. So romantic looking that they made even the drum major who led them in the traditional scarlet tunic and busby look positively prosaic. As they took their place in the center of the square, with the band of the Royal Ulster Rifles in their smart dark green uniforms, through the archway came four trumpeters of the Household Cavalry in their gorgeous cloth of gold tunics mounted on snow-white chargers. They raised their long silver trumpets and blew a fanfare. Then slowly they wheeled and disappeared again through the arch. For a moment there was silence, and then the shining silver drums and bugles of the Ulster Rifles sounded that glorious call. After the retreat, there was complete silence for a few moments, and then the entertainment began. The two bands marched and countermarched in turn, the music changing from the robust beauty of bugle and drum to the plaintive wail of the pipes in a strathspey, or in their own slow march, the saffron kilts. Is there anything more poignant than the sound of pipes playing a slow march in the evening air? slowly the sky changed from flame to crimson to mauve and then to a soft dove grey. And then, as darkness came down, suddenly searchlights blazed out from the four corners of the square, sending blinding shafts of light in all directions, crossing and recrossing in the sky, lighting the buildings, lighting the Duke of Wellington atop his monument in Waterloo Place, lighting the trees in the park to a lurid glow, and finally converging on the Horse Guards Arch itself, with its two Union Jacks fluttering in the breeze. And into that blinding light, shining and shimmering like something in a fairy story, came the trumpeters of the Household Cavalry again to sound a final fanfare.
And one more's got to come. In the postscript from London columnist Alan Melville.
Alan? This is Alan Melville speaking. Last week, your humble columnist columned from Caledonia, and it is no doubt as a result of that clarion call from the land, the mountain, and the flood that this week's London column is so predominantly Scottish in character. The column, indeed, is becoming so tartan-ridden that it might well be called Caledonian column instead of London column. Its producer, a likable enough American, whose ancestors, so he says, were Macintoshes of Macintoshes, has a commendable appreciation of the talents of the Scottish race. And in fact, you very often see outside the studio, when this program is on the air, little groups of disgruntled Sassenachs muttering to each other, "Unfair to the English." One cannot help feeling that the United Nations, in the light of the present international situation, might do a lot worse than study the methods of the Scots in getting where they are and getting what they want. It is our lot, geographically, to be tagged on to another country, England, which is richer than ours in climate and natural resources, if not in wisdom and nobility of character. Yet we Scots realized, after an unfortunate incident 200 years ago, something which has unhappily not been realized by many other countries to this day, that it is no use invading by force. You must do it subtly and by cunning infiltration and gradually, so that only after a long period of years do you succeed in overrunning your neighbor and muscling in on all the best jobs. You must allow the neighbor to go on kidding himself that he is still master in his own house, though if the poor sucker just took a quiet look round, he would realize that the control of his commerce, his trade, his banking, his arts, his London column and all the rest of it had been skillfully wrested from him and is now in the safe hands of the foreigners. If the North Koreans had adopted this method towards the South Koreans, everyone, including the South Koreans, would have been perfectly happy. But no. Intending conquerors seem to think that conquest can only be achieved by a sock on the jaw or a stab in the back. Whereas the canny Scot long ago hung up his claymore, and now, if you ask him, isn't really too sure whether it's a weapon or a species of bagpipe. Indeed, Caledonians, in addition to their other sterling qualities, are no longer stern or wild, except when it comes to football matches between Glasgow Rangers and Glasgow Celtic, to discussing the merits and demerits of performances at the Edinburgh Festival, or to grabbing hold of and clinging on to broadcasting jobs which might thoughtlessly be given to the English. Then they fight like angered stags. Goodbye.
Yes, and it's goodbye too from this edition of Yes, London Column, a radio digest produced by Stephen Eckard, presented by Peter Watson, and which came to you in the North American service of the BBC.